Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Good. Well, it's a special pleasure to welcome you today, both because of our guest and because of the hardiness and sturdiness that your coming here today shows. We look out the window and we're not at all intimidated by the snow. Delighted to have you here. I'd like to thank our host, Mel Weiss, of this important law firm. I'd like to ask you to please turn off your mobile phones. And it's my pleasure to introduce R. James Woolsey as our speaker today. Mr. Woolsey is best known as a former director of Central Intelligence in the beginning years of the Clinton administrations. He hails from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he went to school at Stanford, Oxford, and Yale. He has been since 1973 a partner, or been practicing at the law firm of Shea and Gardner in Washington, D.C. He has on four occasions left the firm for government service. Other terms in the government have been as Undersecretary of the Navy and General Counsel to the United States Senate Committee on Armed Services. Mr. Woolsey is on the board of a number of corporations, many of them startups. He is engaged in the high-tech industry. He is on the board of many nonprofits, and he has been on many government commissions. Most notably, recently he's been on the board of the U.S. Of the Commission on Terrorism. He will be speaking to us about the Middle East and the threats it poses to the United States. I can think of no one better to analyze American interests in the United States from the point of view of our security interests and our national interests than James Woolsey. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome Mr. Woolsey to our podium.
Thank you, Daniel. I was quite honored when Daniel invited me to come speak to you today, but to tell the truth, since I'm A, a lawyer, B, from Washington, D.C., C, served in the Clinton administration, and D, spent some time out at the CIA, I'm pretty well honored to be invited into any polite company for any purposes whatsoever. I also address this distinguished gathering on this subject with some trepidation. I do not pretend to be an expert on the Mideast, but I think there are some points that are relevant to our experience as we sit here today and look toward the next several years that are worth concentrating on. And I'll try to limit this to 20 minutes or so that we can have most of the time for questions. The when he was a very young man, very young major in staff and command school at Leavenworth, Dwight Eisenhower had a professor of military history who told him that if you want to understand how the United States deals with really difficult problems, you need to understand the wagon train. And what Ike thought he meant was looking back on World War I. In a sense, the whole country had pulled together the way that people used to pull together to form a wagon train to get to California. If you think about it, a wagon train is an interesting institution. It's a temporary society. It's almost like a family. It's all for one, one for all. It's a pure meritocracy. If you're the best person to lead it, you'd better lead it. You don't rely on status or wealth or name or anything else. And it accomplishes remarkable things for a brief period of time. People have come from being a shopkeeper or a farmer or whatever, forms this society that does remarkable things for a brief period of time, and then when it gets to California, hey, it's beach time. And everybody goes off to be whatever they want to be before, and they look back on the period of the wagon train as if, as in the words of the title of the wonderful post-World War II movie, as the best years of their lives, as a period in which they accomplished remarkable things, but nobody thought or thinks that's the way you should live all the time. It's what you do when you need to meet a remarkable challenge. This country is extraordinary in being able to pull together almost as a national wagon train from time to time to meet extraordinary challenges. If you declare unrestricted submarine warfare, as the Germans did in 1917 against the United States, or bomb Pearl Harbor, or get into space ahead of us, or invade Kuwait, we will pull together and hand you your, in the vernacular, hat, your derriere, and your overcoat. We do specific challenges with a name and a face very, very well. What we don't do well is deal with the world in between these wagon trains, in between these surges of national organizational capacity. There are a lot of examples from another long stretch of time in which we had just won a war, as we've just won the Cold War. But think back with me for just a moment historically into the mood the United States was in the 1920s. We had just won that time the war to end all wars, the war that was going to make the world safe for democracy. Like today, our culture, our economy, our political system seemed to bestride the world like a colossus. We had a great surge of economic prosperity. We had a great surge of naivete and self-satisfaction. The President of the United States in the 20s said the business of America is business, suggesting that the business of America was only business. We had loaned a great deal of money to our British and French allies who were bled dry in World War I, and when they wanted relief on the interest rate, the President growled, "They hired the money, didn't they?" But my favorite example of the spirit of the 1920s is a man who was remarkable for his patriotism, tough-mindedness, and organizational ability, Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War for both Wilson in World War I and Roosevelt in World War II, but in between, in the late 20s, he was Herbert Hoover's Secretary of State. And he closed down the code-breaking in the State Department because he said, "Gentlemen don't read one another's mail." Well, Stimson was very happy, I think, probably a few years later, when he learned that some folks in the Navy had been being less than gentlemanly with respect to Japanese codes and Japanese mail out on Nebraska Avenue, because that, together with the British code-breaking in the European theater, changed the course of World War II. But that spirit of self-indulgence, of naivete, of the 1920s, is the spirit, I'm afraid, all too frequently, of the United States after it has had a great success, whether it's helping win World War I or helping win the Cold War, during these periods in between the country's ability to form, in a sense, its wagon trains. And we are now, I think, in another such period. Also like the 1920s, the threats to American security are a bit vague and unclear. There isn't crystal clearly a single enemy as there, or group of enemies as there came to be during the Cold War, or as was clear by the end of the 30s and the beginning of the 40s. Things are more uncertain. But we need to somehow be able to organize ourselves to deal with this uncertain world a lot better than our predecessors back a couple or three generations before dealt with the world of the 20s and the early 30s, because the mistakes they made during that interwar period helped make the horrors of the late 30s and the early 40s much greater. Today, it seems to me that the center of most of the major issues that are likely to challenge us early in the 21st century is the Mideast. It's not that the rest of the world is free of trouble. Certainly, Kim Jong-il could come south at some point against South Korea or use a ballistic missile. Certainly, we could run into hostilities in the Taiwan Straits vis-a-vis China if it turns nationalist and aggressive as a way of distracting attention from its social and economic changes and the disruption that those cause. But with respect to Russia, even most of the ways in which we are likely to have trouble, I think, with it have to do with things like the leakage of military technology and other technology that could damage the United States into the Mideast, into, for example, Iran or Iraq. Obviously, the current situation with respect to Israel and the Palestinians is something that is not only difficult as between the two, but could produce a situation to be exploited by someone like Saddam in the near future. The possibility of a Mideast war certainly cannot be set aside right now. And certainly the future of Iran is right at the heart of what we're going to need to deal with, because although President Khatami is in Iranian terms a moderate, although what that would mean in Western terms, I would think, is that his favorite founding father was probably Cotton Mather rather than Thomas Jefferson. He is not by any means a liberal in a Western sense. But nonetheless, Iran has a real constitution. It has a real parliament. It has real reformers. Some are getting killed and imprisoned. But there is at least a struggle underway internally in Iran. And there are tendencies in the society and in the country where one can see some type of possibility of a future that we could live with. I would focus first and foremost for the next several years as the centerpiece of our concerns and the issues we're going to have to deal with in the Mideast on Iraq and on the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein. First of all, it is a recipient of substantial amounts of money illegally and covertly obtained through the sale of oil. It's selling more oil today in dollar terms than it was before the Gulf War, as the sanctions regime has been either subverted or undercut by smuggling or relaxed in recent years. It's been over 2 years now since any UN inspectors were in Iraq. And certainly we know that the chemical and bacteriological weapons programs were not fully stamped out by anything that was done after the Gulf War. Certainly we know that work on ballistic missiles is taking place, and as a result of relatively recent revelations from Iraqi defectors, from German intelligence, from the CIA and elsewhere, it's difficult to contend that Iraq is any more than a few months away from being able to have a nuclear weapon, particularly if it's able to obtain fissionable material from some parts of the former Soviet Union. And it is working very hard to do that. Saddam has mobilized, in a sense, forces now since last fall three times and moved them toward the Jordanian border. The situation is such within the Mideast as a whole that he is gaining, I think, substantial credibility in the Arab street as the new caliph, as the one to take on the infidel, namely us. He is, I think, positioned himself extraordinarily skillfully against, over most of the last 8 years, a particularly flaccid and feckless approach toward dealing with Iraq by the Clinton administration, into a situation where now many of the remaining economic constraints are likely to be relaxed, and unlike the recommendations well stated in the Wall Street Journal last week by Richard Butler, the last head of the UN inspectors, I think it is less than likely, although I would hope they would try, that any sort of a relaxation of sanctions would be undertaken by the Bush administration only if they were able to get a return of inspectors. So far, public statements in that direction have not been encouraging from the new Bush administration. We are seeing interesting phenomena in public commentary on this issue. A remarkably fine editorial in the Washington Post on Sunday has started the process of taking the Bush administration to task for not being firmly enough at the beginning in the position of advocating the removal of Saddam's regime. Certainly some in the Congress who believed and hoped as the Bush administration came in that it was going to take a firm position on removal of Saddam, and were encouraged by the original bombing that took place several weeks ago north of the border of the no-fly zone, have started to express public worries that either the relaxation of sanctions will be too substantial merely to accommodate our European allies and the Russians and Chinese, or if those sanctions are somewhat relaxed and focused more precisely on military hardware and dual-use equipment, that they will not also be matched by renewed calls for inspectors, and if the inspectors are not forthcoming, strong efforts to support an Iraqi opposition. In short, one hopes that the new administration will be as forceful with respect to Iraq as the Washington Post editors suggest, but so far I think one would have to say the jury is out. Will it be possible for the United States, given this set of facts and these conditions in the Mideast, to in any fashion pull itself together to operate one of our marvelous patented nationwide wagon trains, to pull together in a spirit of common purpose, realizing that we do have a serious enemy, one who in relatively short order, if he is not already, will be likely to be armed with weapons of mass destruction. I don't know whether we will be able to or not. I'm going to close by suggesting three things that I think are of substantial importance. The first is short to medium term, but it consists of strong support for the Iraqi opposition and a national commitment, as the Washington Post has urged, to the removal of Saddam's Ba'athist regime. This may well take a substantial amount of time, but in the early 1980s, backing Solidarity in Poland looked like it was going to take a substantial amount of time before, perhaps forever, before the Soviet empire in Eastern Europe was ended, but it took only a few years. Second, it is very important, I believe, that we work promptly and hard on the technology of boost phase intercept for ballistic missile defense. Israel is on the front lines of this need to be able to defend itself against ballistic missiles, but the Arrow system may well not be sufficiently effective against weapons of mass destruction on ballistic missile warheads. I think it is important that we be able to destroy ballistic missiles coming out of rogue states, and I'm afraid I'm still politically incorrect enough to call Saddam and Iran and North Korea rogue states rather than what the Clinton administration State Department said we're supposed to call them, which is states of concern. I guess the State Department would have suggested that if an elephant went wild in an African village and trampled a number of people, it should be called an elephant of concern. But nonetheless, rogue states such as Iraq and others like Iran or in the future perhaps Sudan, Libya, Syria, that would have ballistic missiles in the Mideast, I think are going to have to be dealt with by a boost phase intercept system. Not a system like that which the Clinton administration was pursuing, but one which will be able to destroy ballistic missiles shortly after they are launched, when they are large, slow, and hot, and relatively easily targeted, not after they are already in space and the warhead is small, fast, and cold against the background of space. I had a piece in the National Review last summer on this issue for those who are interested. But I believe work on a effective boost phase intercept system, perhaps at first based on Aegis cruisers, perhaps for Iraq in eastern Turkey, and ultimately based in space, is essential in order for us to be able to maintain our ability to avoid being blackmailed and deterred ourselves, in order for us to be able to come to the defense of a Kuwait, let's say, in the future if it was attacked. I would call your attention to what is happening in what is generally regarded as the more liberal side of the press in the United States on this issue. Look at the very fine piece by Lawrence Kaplan in this week's New Republic on precisely this issue, advocating boost phase intercept missile defense, not of the United States alone, but of our friends and allies as well. Third and finally, much of our policy toward the Mideast is driven directly and indirectly by oil. Oil is the reason that at least China and France, and probably to some extent Russia, is as accommodating toward Iraq, as willing to transfer technology to Iraq and Iran as those countries are. Oil all too frequently results in our cutting corners and accommodating regimes in the Mideast that we should not accommodate. Outside the two democracies of Israel and Turkey, much of the Mideast consists of regimes that are either headed by pathological predators such as Saddam, or vulnerable autocrats, such as the ruling families of many of the states in the Persian Gulf. And the potpourri of pathological predators and vulnerable autocrats is not a recipe for long-term stability. It is a recipe for that region continuing to be the source of tension, of funds derived from oil that can be put into advanced military technology, including weapons of mass destruction, that can be used directly and indirectly to support terrorism and the like. I believe it is a matter of great national importance to begin to move steadily, even if this will not happen overnight, away from dependence on the Mideast and dependence on petroleum as the years go on out to about 2015 or 2020, we will find that not just the majority, but the vast majority of the world's petroleum is going to be coming from the Mideast. So dependence on petroleum is dependence on the Mideast. Senator Richard Lugar and I had a piece that we wrote together in the January-February issue of Foreign Affairs 2 years ago called The New Petroleum, about the prospects of being able to use genetically modified enzymes and yeasts to break down biomass, essentially anything that grows or has grown, including about two-thirds of urban garbage, including agricultural waste, including kudzu, prairie grass, what have you, into constituent sugars to be able to make ethanol. Ethanol, to this point, has been mainly an issue of a tiny, subsidized portion of U.S. agriculture getting some extra money in order to be able to replace about 1% of the U.S. gasoline market. ethanol will never be of substantial importance as long as it is made from feed grains such as corn. It has to be made from something which is extremely cheap, such as biomass waste, in order to be able to begin to replace petroleum as a source of transportation fuel. But this technology is much closer than a lot of people realize. And I think with some added effort, we can begin to see by this period of 2015-2020, when the vast majority of the world's petroleum is going to be coming from the Mideast, I think we will be able to begin to see, if we do the right things now, some steady replacement of gasoline by biomass-based ethanol as a transportation fuel. Well, there are several items on a potential national agenda for dealing with the stresses and challenges that the current situation, and I think for some time into the future in the Mideast, is going to present to us. I think if this country, together with its friends and allies in the Mideast and elsewhere, begins to apply even a fraction of the capacity to organize and focus and make decisions that we've demonstrated at important times in the past, such as during our major wars, we'll be able to deal with this challenge successfully. But if we stay in the same mode as we seem to be in today and as we were in the roaring 20s, we have some, I'm afraid, very serious problems ahead of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm impressed by the scope of your talk, ranging from the 1920s to biomass conversion. It's just exactly the sort of thing I was hoping you would deliver to us. Let me assure you of one thing, though, that as of yesterday, rogue states is back and politically acceptable.
Fantastic.
The president used that phrase, and so states of concern is out. Rogue elephants are back in. Let me start the questioning by asking you what you punted on the question of whether we will be leaving our indulgence and fecklessness and returning to a state of sufficient alarm. You didn't want to predict that. Let me ask you what steps you see as necessary for those of us who would like to get the American people to engage in a wagon train operation. What needs to be done to get people alarmed enough to take the steps that are necessary to protect us from the Iraqi and other threats?
I think that we need to have a clear national policy focusing on the need to replace the Ba'athist regime in Iraq, calling for the reintroduction of weapons inspectors with the fullest range of authority. That will, of course, be completely spurned by Saddam and will not be strongly supported by any of our allies, save and friends, save only probably Israel, Great Britain, and one or two others. We should then, I believe, say, all right, if that's the way it is going to be, we will have a policy of strongly opposing the continuance of the Ba'athist regime in power and do many of those things that are called for in the Iraq Liberation Act of 2.5 years ago that Congress passed and were never implemented by the Clinton administration. Now, I don't know whether the American people would support such a call. It depends on how forcefully and clearly the president and his cabinet exert leadership. There is an interesting and important issue that I think deserves attention. I don't know what the answer will be, but I want to call to your attention a recent book published by the American Enterprise Institute called Study of Revenge. It is about Iraq and the World Trade Center bombing. It's by Laurie Milroy, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. its underlying thesis is that Iraq was behind the World Trade Center bombing, and indeed that Ramzi Youssef, now in prison in Colorado, is in fact an Iraqi asset, and that the plot also to blow up the 12 American airliners in the Pacific, which he was captured in the pursuit of several years ago, was also an Iraqi government operation. You can decide for yourself what you think of that thesis after you look at the book, but I would suggest to any serious students of this issue that Laurie Milroy's thesis deserves serious consideration. If it should turn out to be correct, and there are in the book some testable hypotheses, unlike a lot of allegations of this sort, which are always going to be indeterminate, and one's never going to know how they would turn out, there are several factual investigations which have not yet really been undertaken and could be undertaken that could prove or disprove this notion of Youssef as a tool of the Iraqi government. Should that turn out to be true, I would imagine that the American people would have an added reason to be concerned about Saddam Hussein. But that remains to be seen.
Mr. Woolsey, I'd like to ask you a two-part question. One, at the end of the Gulf War, the previous Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney and Mr. Schwarzkopf others made it clear that they would not go beyond restoring the status quo in Iraq or in Kuwait. Do you feel that they could have deposed Saddam Hussein, and did they blunder by not doing so?
Did everybody hear the question? The question was, at the end of the Gulf War, many of the people who are now in this administration were in the government, did not move on to depose Saddam Hussein. Do I believe that would have been possible and should have been undertaken? I think there's a difference if one looks back. First of all, those of us who are standing here today have perfect 20/20 hindsight, and probably some of the people who were in the administration at the time would look back on actions differently than they did then. But we all do the best we can when we have these responsibilities, and we don't always call it right. My personal view is that it would have been very difficult in terms of managing the coalition for the first Bush administration to have essentially turned left at the Euphrates rather than right, led an attack on Baghdad and conquered the country. It would have been militarily possible, perhaps, and it would have probably entailed a number of casualties and street fighting in Baghdad and the rest. And I can fully understand how President Bush would have made the decision, given the guarantees he gave the other nations who entered the coalition against Iraq, how he would have made the decision not to pursue the war itself. But the United States called effectively during the war for a revolt by the Iraqi people, and that revolt was forthcoming. The Shia in the south and the Kurds and others in the north were heavily engaged in fighting. There were major defections from Iraqi government units, and there was a lot of there were a lot of hostilities in almost all regions of Iraq, certainly in the north and substantially in the south, immediately as the war ended. The United States permitted, as part of the armistice, permitted Saddam to fly helicopter gunships and helicopters and move troops around. His troops would not have been particularly mobile without being able to fly helicopters. In some places in the south, American forces captured large stores of Iraqi ammunition, and those who were fighting against Saddam in the rebellion, the Shias would ask for access to the ammunition, and the stocks, some of them were blown up instead of being turned over. We did not implement immediately a no-fly or no-drive zone in the south. That didn't come along as a no-fly zone until 92. A no-fly zone was implemented relatively early in the north. But I think that was a crucial decision point in the spring of 91, not to permit the success, which was, I think, would have been likely, not certain, but not to have helped the rebels in the South and North more than we did, and not to have permitted a full-scale rebellion against Saddam. Probably the people who were making the decisions at the time felt that Saddam might collapse anyway, and in any case, if we supported the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south, we might end up with an Iraq that was badly fractured and came apart, and that would have been an unstable situation. I served in the Bush administration as an arms control negotiator, Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, and I have a lot of admiration for former President Bush. I think he did a lot very skillfully in foreign affairs, including mobilizing the coalition and especially handling the end of the Cold War and the unification of Germany. But I believe in his administration there was too much of an emphasis on holding nations together, even if those nations were fundamentally at odds with all the values we espouse. The Soviet Union, former Yugoslavia, and Iraq. In all three cases, there was a propensity to believe that if this empire or nation state came apart, what would follow would be worse than if it stayed together. And I believe, on the contrary, it was an excellent thing for the Soviet Union to come apart. It would have been an excellent thing for Yugoslavia to have come apart faster and more cleanly and without any willingness to let Milosevic have his way, and it would have been a fine thing for Iraq to have come apart. Like I say, I've served in a number of administrations, and I've made a lot of decisions myself that I look back on and say, why in the name of God did I do that? And I think everybody ought to have, as he looks back on government service, a certain sense of humility, and I think the first Bush administration got a lot of things right. But this willingness, even approval, of holding the Soviet Union, former Yugoslavia, and Iraq together, believing essentially it was better to bear the ills that they had than fly to others that they knew not of, I think in all three of those cases, in retrospect, it would have been wiser to have been far more forthcoming in supporting the breakup of those three states, or at least tolerating the possibility.
Could you identify yourself? No?
I have two more questions. One is, last week in the European press, there was a lot of coverage of the test of the nuclear law underground in Iraq.
Yes.
Do you have any credence for that? That was the first part of the question. The second was, with the dirty issue that you just mentioned as well, that if you impose someone like Saddam, what comfort level would you have to have
about what would follow in this way? Obviously, the disaster in Yugoslavia
and Afghanistan, the people who are now the
ideological
leaders in Afghanistan, people who
are being strongly supported against the Russians. Well, both good questions. We didn't actually back the Taliban. We supported some of the people who later came to be part of the Taliban. I think that the decision that was made at the time in the 1980s to back the Afghan Mujahideen was the right one. I think it was one of the two or three decisions that the West made, in the United States in particular, that most put pressure on the Soviet Union and had a very major hand in the Soviet Union coming apart in 1989 to 1991. Certainly some of the blowback, some of the results, such as we see in Afghanistan today, has been most unfortunate, but it was, I think, the decision at the time to back the Mujahideen was the right one. You don't always know what is going to follow, but I think, as I said before, that if we had acquiesced to and even backed the split up of Yugoslavia, we wouldn't have had Milosevic around nearly as long, killing as many people as he did. You make the best decision you can in these circumstances, and there's no iron law of history, I think, that would say you're always right to support the breakup of an authoritarian state. It depends on how bad the state was. But Soviet Union, former Yugoslavia under Milosevic, and Iraq under Saddam Hussein are, I think, clearly bad enough that the breakup could have been tolerated, and certainly destruction of the regimes would have been as early as possible would have been a good thing. Now, with respect to, I believe it's Leoni, is the Iraqi who came out, sat for interviews with the BBC. I saw a BBC special on him. I was in Ireland a couple of days ago, and there was a long BBC special on Leoni's alleged revelations that there had been a nuclear test of a 10-kiloton device in a cavern in Iraq just before the Gulf War, I think in 1989, with smuggled South African fissionable material. That it was a relatively simple shotgun device, similar to the Hiroshima bomb designed by the United States over a half a century ago, and that Leoni had gone back into to Iraq. But a lot of what he said, at least according to the BBC story, and according to the story, and I believe it was the Sunday Times a week ago Sunday in London. It's looked credible. I got to say, I don't know anything from my government service and from talking to friends in who were in the government of Israel at the time that would suggest that the governments thought that had happened. And I think you have to take the Leoni allegations at this point as not proven. And I must say, I think if he had actually had a nuclear weapon, Saddam might have behaved rather differently than he did in 1991, certainly. But a lot of what Leoni said is at least very interesting, and seismic events, in fact, can be masked by bombs being set off in caverns and decoupled from the surrounding geology. And there were some seismic events in that part of Iraq at that time, etc. So I've got to say, I really don't know, but I think the most important thing are the revelations over the course of the last several months that have come out about the extent of Iraqi work on nuclear weapons, and the proposition that whether or not they were able to detonate something in 89, they are probably to this point only a few months away from having a bomb if they can get the fissionable material. And unfortunately, that material is rather loosely controlled in the former Soviet Union, and much of it through organized crime and otherwise is potentially for sale. The long pole in the tent from the point of view of developing a primitive but nonetheless nuclear weapon that would actually explode of a few kilotons, the long pole in the tent is getting the fissionable material, either highly enriched uranium or plutonium. It is the risk that may find its way out of Belarus or Ukraine or Russia into the hands of the Iraqis, and that they could put that together with the work that they've done in the past and with some of the very bright scientists that they have, who were educated, many of them, in the UK and in other places in the West, and have a weapon within a matter of months. So I'm afraid we're going to have to live with the uncertainty for some time that whether or not Iraq actually tested something in 89 or not, the likelihood that it could have something within a few months of getting hold of fissionable material is going to be a reality now for the foreseeable future.
Perhaps this is the right moment for me to make a plug for the Middle East briefing after this one on April 2nd. Is that right? April 2nd? Which will be, we'll have Khidr Hamza, the author of the book Saddam's Bomb Maker, a nuclear scientist who fled Iraq, and like our today's speaker, subject of a biographical sketch in the New York Times Magazine recently. So, 2nd of April, Hamza Khidr. You'll be getting the official announcement later. Daniel, yes.
What do you think of the national saving policy? Trying to remove Saddam is a good idea. We've seen that given the threat of things like the World Trade Center bombing, you either want to act immediately or at least keep quiet until you're ready to act, and then act suddenly as opposed to announcing it.
Well, if we were starting from a blank slate, I have no problem with deception and covert action. Indeed, I think that is a sometimes a useful way for the United States and its friends and allies to do these sorts of things. I think the situation now, however, is a result of the Clinton administration's fecklessness over the course of 8 years and the passage of the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998 is that it would be functionally impossible for us really to deceive anybody or keep the secret of providing aid to the Iraqi National Congress or any other resistance organization. I think that at this point we are unfortunately likely to have to do this in the sort of plain old straightforward American way of just sort of saying, we think this is an awful regime and it needs to be replaced, and backing the opposition groups, and I think being prepared to use force in support of them, at least from the air. I think if Iraqi opposition groups are able to get hostilities started in either the north or south against Saddam, we need to maintain not only no-fly zones, but no-drive zones. I think the Clinton administration should have done this in 1996 when Saddam allied himself with one of the two major Kurdish organizations and attacked against the Iraqi resistance in the north. We were flying overhead in F-16s watching the Iraqi resistance get killed. I don't see any reason why decision couldn't have been made then to ban Iraqi government vehicles north of a certain line as well as Iraqi government aircraft. Should we be willing also to use ground forces in the area? That's another and a much bigger and in many ways a much more difficult question. But during the Cold War, with the Afghan Mujahideen and with the Contras and in other circumstances, we backed more or less publicly. Some of this was CIA covert action, but it was pretty highly advertised at the time. We backed rebel groups opposing communist domination. And Saddam is at least as bad, if not worse, than many of the communists at the peak of their power. And I see no reason why we shouldn't go ahead and take the national steps necessary to support a removal of the regime.
Richard Balfour, one of your successors, Lord Tenet, was used by the British administration in the kind of mediating role in Israel and the Palestinian Authority. That caused some controversy within the Congress, particularly with Senator Shelby of the Intelligence Committee. Can you give me some of the advantages and disadvantages of putting DCI in such a position? Also, in conjunction with that, the fact that the CIA has been used to train the Palestinians.
Did everybody hear the question? The question is, what do I think about the Clinton administration's having asked DCI Tenet and the CIA to take the role that they did in the negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis, to have the rather open and upfront role they had as mediators, and also to engage in some of the security training that they did of the Palestinians. Intelligence officers in a number of countries and DCIs themselves have been used in these kinds of roles in the past to carry messages, to be a quiet mediator and broker outside the glare of publicity, to meet with groups that for one reason or another would be officially approved in some way if the State Department representatives overtly met with them. So this, much of this is not entirely new to people in American intelligence. What was very different about it was that it was public. It was not a senior CIA officer quietly going back and forth between senior Palestinians and Israelis and suggesting on the one hand this and on the other hand that at the suggestion of his own government. It was all out there in the press in front of everybody. And I had some qualms about that. Aspects of it made me somewhat concerned. But I can't really say that there was anything that was hugely different except for the overt nature, except for some press reports. And there were press reports that suggested that in some cases the CIA was supposed to be reporting from one of the parties to the other on what the other one was doing. Now, I don't think that occurred. I don't think George Tenet would have let his agency get involved in doing that. Had it occurred, it would have been, I think, most unfortunate, because the CIA works for the President of the United States and the United States government, not for another government, and you don't want to get your intelligence institution in the business of reporting on one foreign country or entity to another one, saying whether the Palestinians have really locked up as many weapons as they say they have and reporting on that fact to the Israelis or for them or vice versa. I think that would have been a real departure and a mistake, but I have no reason to believe that it occurred. As far as the security training to the Palestinians goes, I don't know the exact nature of that. Some aspects of security training are relatively straightforward and indeed can help groups understand things like the importance of human rights and not using torture and that sort of thing. Others can enable a group to do things that you'd rather ultimately didn't do. And I don't know exactly what the nature of the training that took place of the Palestinians was by the CIA, but some types of training that they could have undertaken would have been fine, I think.
To bring two of your, I guess, world threat scenarios together, there have been reports after this latest bombing we undertook in Iraq that there were Chinese, part of the reason I suppose we didn't hit some of the targets, or chose some of the targets we chose was because there were Chinese on the ground, I guess, providing fiber optic equipment and so on to the Iraqis. I wonder if your take on this is something that's, and the Chinese now seem to show up everywhere we want to bomb. I wonder if your take is China becoming a serious player and concern in the Middle East, or is this something that just kind of muddied the waters in North America?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay. Question is about the Chinese involvement in the Middle East, and particularly most recently when it appears as if there were Chinese laying fiber optic cable to Iraqi surface-to-air missile sites and radars. Whether this is a major trend or policy of the Chinese government or an ad hoc event, I guess. I don't know which it is. I think that, like Russia, to some extent, Chinese institutions, laboratories, firms, organizations that are part of the PLA and the like, allege that they have autonomy, and people at the top of the Chinese government will say, we didn't know what was going on, and sometimes they may be right, because there may be corruption involved and some subordinate group going off and doing something to make money without broadcasting widely within their system what they're doing. But I think as a general proposition, if you have any substantial number of people and relatively high technology happening, you've got to assume are being used. You've got to assume that people at the top of the Chinese government knew that this was going on. And much of the trade in high technology that's relevant to the military between Russia and China, between China, Russia and the Mideast, between China and the Mideast, is highly corrupt. Everybody who's involved in it is lining their pockets. Probably takes a substantial amount of effort to turn it off. It's not impossible that it can be turned off, but it takes effort to do so. And I think it was interesting that the original Chinese reaction seemed to be indignation, and then there was a pause as they said they would look into it, which suggests that they found out that at the top levels of the government that, in fact, there had been some Chinese entity there laying the fiber optic cable and helping out the Iraqis. I think we're going to see more of this from both Russian and Chinese entities, firms, subordinate parts of the military-industrial complexes of both countries. Most of this technology originates in Russia. The Russian military-industrial complex sells more to China than it does to Russia. And the Russian military-industrial complex is still technologically rather advanced and looking for customers. And the Russian budget is nowhere near enough to absorb it. So you get a lot of flow to China and then flow from China to other places. And I think that directly and indirectly what comes out of Russia is going to find its way to rogue states in the Mideast, and we're going to almost always for some years be in this posture of being unpleasantly surprised to realize that Chinese fiber optic cable or Russian guidance systems for missiles or whatever are showing up in the hands of Iraqis and Iranians.
We have time for one, and if we're lucky, two questions. George.
With reference to your statement that we perhaps erred in not encouraging the breakup of the Soviet Union or Yugoslavia, et cetera, do you really think this is a case of lack of will, or is it not also, at least to some extent, a case of not understanding Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union as well, the tremendous number and variety of ethnic tensions inherent in those countries?
I think it was a position of caution. I think it was a position that we've got a weak Soviet Union, we've got a weak Yugoslavia, we've got a weakened Iraq, better a weakened devil that we know than a situation in which various states are spinning off and may be in the hands of completely uncontrollable people who have access to militarily important technology. I mean, it needs to be remembered that it took us a lot of effort, and this is something both the Bush and Clinton administration did reasonably well, I think. It took a lot of effort to get nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Kazakh and fissionable material out of the hands of the Kazakhs and the Ukrainians and the Belarusians and so forth, and kind of get it back into Russia so you don't end up with four or five new nuclear powers in the former Soviet Union. That was some of the type of thing, I think, that First President Bush and Brent Scowcroft and some of the others who made these decisions were worried about. And it's not fanciful. There were real concerns. But the speech First President Bush gave in Kiev back in whenever it was, 1990, I guess, sometimes called the Chicken Kiev speech, willingness to go along with the lack of willingness to challenge Milosevic early in his attacks either on Slovenia or Croatia, and the lack of support for the Shia in the south in the spring of 91, I think we're all driven by this worry of what you'd have if you had a breakup. If the Shia succeed in the south in Iraq, are they going to then join Iran and make the mullahs even stronger than they already are? That kind of worry. And like I said, it's not a fanciful worry. It's just that it seems to me in retrospect that the first Bush administration tilted too much that way.
Last question, Martin. If you were to conclude tomorrow that Iraq had developed a weaponized nuclear capability, how would that change your options in terms of being able to do it?
If we were to conclude tomorrow that Iraq had weaponized, had a nuclear weapon itself, how would that change our options? I think what it does is makes it more urgent to try to do something quickly, particularly with a sea-based boost phase intercept system for ballistic missile defense, because if they have a nuclear weapon, as long as they're putting it on an aircraft, at least an initial generation is likely to be an aircraft-carried weapon, at least our friends and allies in the area, helped by us, have air defenses, and you've got some you can deal with. The problem is if you marry up a weapon of mass destruction, nuclear or bacteriological especially, with a ballistic missile against which you have no defenses, and the only defensive system really functioning in that part of the world now is the Israelis, but that needs to be improved. So I think it means that you want to work very hard and very fast on let's say modifying the Aegis system so it can do boost phase intercept, or putting aside in eastern Turkey to be able to do boost phase intercept against anything coming out of Iraq. I think it means that the importance of backing the Iraqi resistance and being quite serious about trying to get something started in terms of defections from Saddam's military forces to them and the like is more important. I wouldn't change what I suggested, but I think that it makes all those things considerably more urgent. Thank you.
Is Osama bin Laden a separate headache, or is he in any way tied into this?
Can you ask?
I'll answer it after. You want me to try it now or after?
Anyway. Who wants to talk?
Come on. Anybody wants to talk, just come up afterwards and we'll talk.
Thank you very much, Jim. Let me just conclude by saying that we're grateful for you coming, especially by train this morning early on. And to remind you that we ask you to put your name tags in the bin on your way out, and to mention our next few events will be on the 26th of March. We have Abdul Hadi Palazzi, who'll be telling us, he's an Islamic scholar, who'll be telling us how the fundamentalist Muslims have it all wrong. I mentioned to you before on the 2nd of April, Khidr Hamza, who is an escaped Iraqi nuclear scientist, and a month after that we have Gershom Gorenberg, author of a book on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, its role in current politics.